history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there. Amazing stories, sometimes hard to believe stories, waiting to be told if we'll just ask a few questions and be patient enough to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do that, we're always better off for it. We're educated, we're entertained. Often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. At the National World War II Memorial this week, General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, gave the keynote address in a ceremony commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Iwo Jima, a battle his father survived as a World War II Marine. Something else happened in the early stages of that five-week battle for that small but strategically located volcanic island. It's something that hasn't happened at all in the 75 years since. The sinking of the escort carrier USS Bismarck Sea on February 21, 1945, remains the last time an American carrier was sunk by enemy action. We're going to focus on that 75th anniversary this week through the memories of two men who survived that tragic sinking that claimed the lives of more than 300 of their shipmates. Steve Marusich, one of 11 children in his family in Binghamton, New York, was a rear-facing gunner on a TBF Avenger torpedo plane flying off the deck of the USS Bismarck Sea.
Well, I tell you, everyone was excited because it was the biggest fleet of ships I'd ever seen. There were hundreds of ships in the area, battleships, cruisers, heavy cruisers, destroyers, big carriers, and there were about a dozen of us little guys. And we were there for almost a week, and it was our responsibility to fly over the island and drop our bombs and try to make things difficult for the Japanese, to get ready so that the Marines could come ashore.
When you say you'd never seen a bigger fleet, a bigger group of ships, when you got to Iwo Jima and you saw so much firepower on the American side, did you ever think, we need all this for this little island? Is that something that occurred to you?
Yes, I was surprised that the Japanese were so well fortified. They had to be all underground because that island was sure peppered every day for 6 or 7 days. The big 16-inch guns from the battleships and the big carriers had much more firepower than we did, but that was our duty, to just go over and drop bombs on the island and see if you could soften them up.
And when you were flying those missions and dropping bomb after bomb and knowing all these other planes were too, did you see anything down below that made you think that this was going to be much of a fight?
No, it didn't look that ominous. It was just an island with very little vegetation, and we kept wondering why the heck we were there, because it didn't look like there was much on the island to be fighting for, although later on I found out that that airstrip was vital to the B-29s to hit Tokyo, so that was our mission, to see if we can't soften it up and maybe give the Marines a better chance to get the island.
For people who haven't been there, and I think most of us listening have not been to Iwo Jima, we've certainly seen pictures of the giant mound, Mount Suribachi on one end of the island, and then more of a flat strip going from there. What did it look like to you, and certainly from the air? Was there something striking about that location?
Nothing striking other than Suribachi at one end, and it looked like a simple thing to get that island, but when you found out that there were thousands of Japanese underground, and the Marines had a heck of a time getting there because there was very little foliage or shrubs or anything to cover. So when they invaded that island, those Marines were outstanding and to be able to get those Japanese out of there.
And early on in that invasion, Steve, after your primary job of hitting the island before the invasion was done, there was a bit of a commotion aboard your carrier. What was that all about?
On the day that we met the enemy, my shipmate and I were sitting on the on the hangar deck aft on the starboard side, and we were getting ready to go eat. It was about 6:30 at night, and as we were sitting there talking, ready to go and to start our chow that night, why, the guns start firing off and the general quarter sounded, and we stood up and turned towards the bow of the ship. And just as we turned, the first suicide plane hit us about, 20 or 30 feet in, on the starboard side where my shipmate and I were standing. And we were blown down the hangar deck about, I would say maybe 20, 30 feet. And the explosion hit me in the back of the head and my back, my legs. And after laying there a few seconds, I got up and started walking towards the bow of the ship. And not walking very well, I was kind of wondering if my legs were broken or not. Anyway, by the time I got up forward about another 20, 30 yards, the second suicide plane came down and hit our above our after elevator and knocked our torpedoes off, and the torpedoes began exploding, and the ship was damaged very severely. And another half a minute or so, the skipper came on and told us to abandon ship. Moving forward, I went up to the forward gun sponson where there were, I think, 20-millimeter cannons. They had a big line over the side, and I was fortunate I got up that far, took my helmet off. My jacket was gone. It was blown off my back. And I went over the side on the big line, and after dropping a few feet, we're up about 45, 50 feet, and one of the shipmates above me was stepping on my hands, so I let go of the rope and went down about 25 feet and hit the water and started floating and swimming away from the ship. After that, we started congregating out in the sea, and because the Japanese were still in the area, the other ships couldn't turn their lights on because the Japs were still strafing us in the water and still firing at ships. So it was about 4 hours later that they began to pick us up and the lights came on. And they pulled me aboard a destroyer escort, and they picked up almost 400 of us. And I was fortunate to be put aboard a destroyer. We were given, alcohol nourishment. Most of us were very cold and had very little energy, and we took all our clothes off. They gave us new clothes, and the sailors on board that destroyer escort were very helpful in pulling all of us aboard and giving us some alcohol. Either it was brandy or some other thing to take the chill off our bodies. And in those days, I wasn't familiar with that alcohol, so it was quite an exciting to get such heat in your stomach. So the next day, they took us into Iwo Jima and put us on a big transport and made it into a hospital ship, and it was right below Mount Suribachi. And later that morning, the skipper came on and announced to all of us, if they would look up on the mountain, you'll see the flag flying. And the flag went up on Iwo Jima, the one that most people in World War II recognize as a victory symbol for those Americans who wanted us to be successful in the war.
And I've heard a lot of stories that people have about where they were when they saw that flag go up, and it has symbolic value for just about everyone. But I imagine for you, as someone who's just had your ship sunk and you were almost killed, to see something like that probably had a lot of symbolic value for you.
It was very emotional to all of those sailors that were around me. They all were so enthused, and we were so happy that the Americans went up on that mountain, and the Japs were still in that mountain because they were shooting at us in the harbor, and the Marines still got up there and put that flag up there. And the symbol of our flag sure is a freedom symbol to all the people of the world. I think we just can't imagine how much it means to us to see the flag flying and to know we're still free.
Let's go back, because you brought us to that story of where you were when you saw Mount Suribachi, but that was a pretty eventful way that you ended up where you were. So you're on this carrier, and you mentioned the first suicide plane, the kamikaze. Now, had you seen a kamikaze attack before that day on February 21st?
Well, we did have some occasion to see them operate at Leyte, but not in this large numbers. And to see them, I was on the hangar deck, so I didn't get to see all of them flying, but my shipmates told me they usually like the Bendix air races. They were just running around those ships, firing at everybody, and I don't know why he chose our carrier, but they used it as a target, and they took us down. I didn't know how to sew very well, and I had safety wire going through my buttonhole, so I didn't have any buttons. So when that first one took me, why, it blew my jacket off, and I had to laugh because I had no buttons. And but when I got in the water, after spending about 4 hours or so in the water, it was very cold. People don't realize it, but the water was like, I don't know, they say it was like 57 degrees, and swells were real high. I don't know, maybe 15 feet or so, maybe 20. And floating around there, after 3 or 4 hours, your body begins to feel the effects of the exposure. And it was very difficult when the destroyer escort came close. I could see the screws turning in the fantail, and they had the cargo net over to the side. I grabbed the cargo net, and I'm a pretty husky kid, and I couldn't pull myself up. I was pretty weak. And those sailors, they were dragging us out. They reached down and pulled me up, threw me on the deck, and they grabbed the next guy. They picked 400 of us up. And they were heroes, too, I'm telling you. Those sailors were really busy getting all of us survivors out of the water in very rough conditions.
I don't want to belabor the point, but I think everyone at home is trying to imagine themselves in your shoes or in your life preserver at that moment. But this is everybody's worst nightmare. Your ship has been hit. After 90 minutes, it's completely under the water. It's sunk. You're still floating in the water, not knowing if you'll ever be picked up. What was going through your mind? What kept you going? How did you survive that situation?
What was so interesting about it was the fact that one or two of my shipmates came by, and one had a leaking life preserver, and I showed them how to inflate it. There were little tubes along the side that you could release and blow the chambers up, and so I showed them how to do that. Another one came and did the same thing. And then I saw a group of 15 or 20 around a small life raft, and I figured I better not get too close. I'll stay away, and when the lights come on, they'll see that big group around that life raft, and I'll paddle closer to it so I can get aboard when they find them. So that was my experience in the water, and with a Jap strafing us there, that was a very dastardly deed. I was really amazed that they would do that.
Because you guys are defenseless in the water. You can't fire at them.
Yeah, you see the bullets hitting the water, and you just hope that they don't get you.
How close did they come to you?
Well, I was maybe about 15, 20 feet away from the splashes of the bullets. But fortunately, you could hear some screams going on. A lot of the guys got hit. And one of the reports that was written about our night's attack explains that we lost quite a few boys in the water because of the strafing.
And in total, more than 300 men from your ship died that day?
We had a total, I think it went around 321 or two that never made it and that were missing. And we put a plaque in their honor on the Yorktown. I think it's in Charleston. And we dedicated this monument with all the names of those that didn't make it, and to honor them for what they did to preserve our freedom.
You know, I don't want to put any words in your mouth or put my thoughts in yours, but I'm just wondering if you spent 4 hours in the water, and you had talked about when you heard the news of Pearl Harbor, you were singing in your church choir. So was the guy raised in the Orthodox Church saying a few prayers while you're floating in the water for 4 hours?
Well, I think it was a constant memory of, if the Lord's going to help me, now's the time to do his job, because we're so busy trying to stay afloat, and my preserver wasn't that functional. I had to blow it up a couple times, and the only thing was that when we're on board ship, we had to wear this. It was a life preserver, and it was the order of the day. Everybody wore one of those belts. So when we went over the side, most everyone that I was familiar with had one of these on.
What do you think the chances are that you would have survived without one of those?
Very nil. I'm not a very good swimmer, and to be in the water that long, I don't know how to float very well. I can dog paddle a while, but I couldn't have done it for 3 hours because that's how long it took before they were able to pick me up, almost 4 hours. But anyway, I'm glad I survived, and I think the Lord was on my side.
Steve Marusich would use the GI Bill to earn a bachelor's degree at Western State in Colorado, then a master's at Stanford. He was a longtime teacher and administrator, as well as an outstanding golfer. Steve passed away in 2015, but his incredible memories live on as we mark 75 years since the sinking of the USS Bismarck Sea, the last time any American carrier was sunk in combat. When we come back, another survivor of that tragedy who's still with us, and you won't believe what he endured on February 21st. 1945. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.